From Loyola University Chicago School of Law in WLUW, this is The Podvocate. We are law students exploring the vanguard of the legal world with experts from our backyard and beyond. Today we're going to be talking about navigating law school and best practices for beginning a career as a young lawyer. Subscribe to The Podvocate wherever you get your podcasts and join us every Saturday evening on WLUW 88.7 Chicago. For more information about this episode and our guests, please visit our website at thepodvocate.com and check out our social media pages. Our hosts today are Karan Gaushal and Neka Ugu. We are joined by Professor Neil Williams.
As I'll be graduating in May, you know, I'm definitely excited to sit down with you, Professor, and learn about your pathways after finishing law school. But I do want to, you know, really start at the beginning. So before we dive into your time as a professor, your professional experiences, even before law teaching, I'd love for you to just tell some of our listeners a little bit about what led you to law school in the first place, Professor.
Okay. When I was growing up, I had a great love and passion for books. I ended up being the first Black valedictorian from a high school in Atlanta, then known as Grady, now known as Ida B. Wells. From there, I went to Duke University. And while at Duke, I had a great passion and enjoyment of my classes in English. I loved reading the texts, thinking about the texts, how the lives of the authors are reflected in the text, and how what happened to that person and their perspectives played into my own worldview. Probably if I had followed my first instincts, I would have gone on to English grad school. But people at that time, I guess, by the time I was graduating from Duke, it was around 78, 1978. And there were all these stories of graduates, PhDs with English degrees driving cabs. So I decided to take the more practical route and go to law school. In the meantime, I read a book that really focused me on the value of a legal education and on the important role that law plays in our society. There is a book, Simple Justice by Richard Kluger, that really transformed my perspective. It was about the story of Charles Hamilton Houston, who was one of the very first Black graduates of Harvard University. He was on the Law Review there, and when he graduated, very early in the 20th century, very early in the 1900s. Charles Hamilton Houston went on to teach at Howard University. Back then, outside of a few extremely gifted people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Charles Hamilton Houston, the doors to these Ivy League institutions were closed. So he went on to teach at Howard University, and there his passion was through a very carefully crafted series of cases to bring about the fall of Plessy versus Ferguson. Among the students at Howard that he recruited for this task was a young Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall would not have been at Howard, but for the fact that the University of Maryland refused him admission. It was not that long ago, and we and many of our graduates had the same experience. There was this time when very talented students, Black students, throughout the South and in a lot of other states too, there was a policy of not admitting clearly qualified Black graduates into law schools. Indeed, some states would even pay a stipend to help a Black student find a school, a law school in the North who would admit them. But there was this policy, wasn't that long ago, of closing the doors to even the Thurgood Marshalls of the world. But with serendipity, that Thurgood Marshall ended up at Howard with Charles Hamilton Houston. Charles Hamilton Houston was the ultimate mentor, and together they crafted a series of cases that ultimately led to the Brown versus Board of Education decision. Unfortunately, Charles Hamilton Houston died a couple of years before the Brown decision came down. But in a very famous recording, he said then that it was apparent that Brown was going to fall and that his life's work would have meaning. So when I looked at all the effort that went into getting the Supreme Court to rule in Brown versus Board of Education, that legally segregated education violated the Constitution, and how people were so selfless, both Blacks, whites, and every ethnicity. People got together in the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and other organizations and fought to improve American society, and that I had been the beneficiaries of what they had done. That really instilled in me a drive to go to law school. Also, in law school, like English, basically, you're reading a lot of texts. You're reading statutes and decisions, and you're figuring out how those statutes and decisions, how that text animates the world, the legal world outside of that text. So I went to law school. I was very fortunate. I went to the University of Chicago on the South Side. I had graduated summa cum laude and Phi Beta Kappa from Duke. I had the University of Chicago was gracious enough to extend me a scholarship. But the deeper I dug in, the more I knew that ultimately made that right decision to go into law. Following graduation from law school, I worked for George N. Layton, a federal judge in Chicago, for 2 years. Judge Layton was a Howard graduate, undergrad, and he was admitted to Harvard University. Again, I'm running across these great people who had a time when doors were closed, most of us managed to operate the system and go places like Harvard. But these original pioneers always felt that it was necessary for them to reach back and create opportunities. Judge Layton, before he was Judge Layton, came to Chicago and was active in civil rights cases in the 1940s, 50s. In one case, he represented a couple that moved into the suburb of Cicero, and they were greeted in the suburb of Cicero, the Chicago suburb of Cicero, with violence. People were burning crosses on the lawn, throwing things into the windows, just like in the South. But Judge Layton represented them in their move to Cicero. Saw to it that the legal work was done so that they moved into Cicero. And then he was charged when the mobs came along. He was charged with inciting a riot, believe it or not, for opening up possibilities for Black people to live in Cicero. He called in none other than Thurgood Marshall. Thurgood Marshall did a great job of representing him. They dropped the charges relating to his supposedly having incited a riot. But there was a network of lawyers, Black lawyers and other lawyers too, who were really devoted to the cause of racial justice at a time when, trust me, there was no money to be made in the cause of fighting racial injustice, who laid the foundation, laid the path for me to be where I am and all of us behind them. After working for Judge Layton for a couple of years, I went to Sidley and Austin for 5 years. I was an associate in the Transactional Corporate and Securities Group. While I was there, even though I received great mentorship and I learned a lot of things, and certainly the name Sidley and Austin on my resume opened up some opportunities. But I wasn't really fulfilled. I felt as if I was helping wealth to transfer between rich people, and that I perhaps lost a perspective on social justice. Even though I strongly encourage students to go into transactional work, people of color are widely underrepresented in transactional work. Loyola does a great job, is very well known for its litigators, but going to transactional work too. But my wife was at Chapman Cutler at the time, a partner at Chapman Cutler, and Steve Pugh, a Loyola graduate, was one of her colleagues. And she mentioned to him my interest ultimately in teaching law. After all, I wanted to be an English professor. I wanted to go over, present text and interpret the text and talking about how it affects the world. Steve Pugh put me in contact with Deans Nina Pell and Tom Haney. There was no opening at the time, but they explained what Loyola was about, and I knew that I wanted to become a part of Loyola and its Jesuit mission. A year or two later, they called me and said there was an opening on the faculty. Would I apply? I did apply. I've now I started teaching at Loyola in the fall of 1989, and now for, well, soon it'll, next year it'll be 35 years. I've been at Loyola. I've seen Loyola grow and evolve, and it's been a great experience. And I'd be remiss if I didn't mention Norman Amaker. When I came here, Norman Amaker was the sole African American professor. He, like Dean Nina Appel, had been in the 1960 class at Columbia Law School, the class that graduated in 1960. Also in that class was Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She spent her first 2 years at Harvard Law School, and her last year at Columbia Law School. Her degree is from Harvard, but she was with Norman Amaker, Nina Appel, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg in that 1960 Columbia University Law School class. The interesting thing about their presence, they were the Nina Appel and Ruth Bader Ginsburg were the only two women. And needless to say, Norman Amaker was the sole Black member of that class at Columbia Law School. So it wasn't that long ago. We're talking 1960. It wasn't that long ago that the practices in American law schools and American universities to exclude people on the basis of race and gender. The quality of education is much, much, so much better in a diverse environment. I just love going around the halls of the law school and seeing people from different ethnicities and backgrounds talking to each other, learning from each other. Just a couple of weeks ago, the Asian law students had a wonderful reception in the faculty lounge area. The spirituality of that event and bringing people together, that's what legal education is about. Studies show that groups collectively make better decisions than individuals. And diverse groups collectively make even better decisions. When you're out in practice, even though I have qualms about the way we grade law school, in law school, we grade you on how well you do on an exam off the top of your head, when you don't have the opportunity to consult with other people. I'm scared. You won't be a good lawyer if you go into practice like that. The best lawyers always consult other people, always seek out other perspectives, and we aren't lone guns. We work in groups. We should work in diverse groups. And you have to be able to get together with people from all kinds of backgrounds in the city of Chicago. People in the clerk's offices, people who invite you into buildings, the people who have access to all kinds of resources, all from all kinds of backgrounds. You have to be able to communicate with people in order to work together, and law firms are finding for themselves the value of diversity. Lawyers are just much more effective when working in diverse groups.
Professor Williams, I'm wondering what you would tell, Loyola students or law students in general who do come from, diverse backgrounds. I myself, I'm a first generation law student. My parents were born in Nigeria, and in a lot of ways, I'm very excited to be graduating in May, but I'm also recognizing this is a, this decision is something I think about. It's something that is on my mind. As I'm entering, the public interest law space, I have siblings that are also interested in law school. So I guess what I want to hear from you is, what do you tell, students like Karan, myself, and our listeners? How do we sort of maintain hope or, collectively come together in the face of this decision? The reality is that, decisions don't always go the way we want them to. And I'm sure in your time you've seen changes, societal and cultural shifts. So could you speak a little bit to maybe how you see this shift being something that, although it's negative and scary, potentially could have a positive outcome or yield to, people coming together, right? And then pushing back.
What I want to remind students of is the trajectory of social justice. Loyola is very proudly focused on social justice issues. The law school has an anti-racist, anti-oppression mission statement. It's look at the long arc of history in this country. Dr. King would often use a quotation from an abolitionist. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. Now we are in a period following what many would consider the height of Black empowerment, election of Barack Obama in 2008, his re-election in 2012. It appeared that all these struggles for the progress that had been made were being realized. But just like that period following Reconstruction, when there was a backlash against Black empowerment, the empowerment of people of color, we're seeing the same sorts of things happen now. People would ask me, what is the difference between America now and the way it used to be? I grew up in Jim Crow segregation, the later years of Jim Crow segregation. I remember segregated water fountains going into the side of buildings a whole bit. And what was the big achievement? And in the late 1990s and early 2000s, I would say, you know what? There's still people in America who are opposed to equality. But it used to be, I would say, they controlled states, they controlled institutions. So we have made progress. We can turn around and we can see Barack Obama being elected. I remember a conversation I had with Derrick Bell. I said, Derrick, you're always so down. You've really accomplished something. You really have. Look at what we've. And Derrick Bell shook his hand and said, Neil, Neil, Neil. As if to say I was naive. Derrick Bell was right. He knew the backlash was coming. You're going to have to go out, NECA, and help bring the world together again. There are people intentionally tearing people apart. It's not going to be easy, NECA. There are going to be times when you're going to say, for you and Karan, oh, I keep working and working and trying to do things to make the world a better place, to bring people together, but things keep happening. Terrible things just keep happening. And I believe that we're losing the battle. But think back to all the generations of persons before you who fought this battle, and progress collectively is being made. There are times when some of that progress is reversed. You get into the trenches and you try to regain it. But you're part of a centuries-long struggle. You'll be the custodians of it. The arc of the moral universe is long. Maybe it bends towards justice, but it's an asymptote. We'll never fully get there. That's why there's always something to fight for.
As someone who's been at Loyola for so long, what have you noticed in all of your experiences that makes a student successful?
Karan, the successful students aren't necessarily the ones with the highest GPAs. Now, a lot of my students with high GPAs gone on and done marvelous things, but it's not necessarily them. Because I'm going to be honest, the skills we test on law school exams represent just a portion of the skill sets needed to be a successful attorney. In my experience, students who end up being the best attorneys overall are those who know how to communicate, those who know how to get to know other people and understand other people, can talk to other people without being condescending, those who network. When you get in front of a jury, you can have an IQ of 160. But if you don't know how to talk to real people and explain things in ways they can understand, you aren't going to be successful in front of that jury. Also, when you get, let's say, on the other side, let's say you're doing transactional work and you're making a presentation to a corporate board. Again, you have to be able to explain things to people that aren't overly technical, but break things down in a way that makes what you're saying understandable to other people. So the ability to communicate, the ability to network, the ability to befriend people. Coupled with hard work. The hard work is a key part of the equation, too. Those collectively are the skill sets I've seen in graduates who are most successful. And like I said, those graduates aren't always necessarily the people with the highest GPAs. I'm going to take you back to Plessy versus Ferguson. In Plessy versus Ferguson, all the judges but one. So the inherent evil in the separate but equal ruling. All of those other justices like today were graduates of Ivy League law schools, Harvard, Yale, Columbia, and so forth. And Justice Harlan graduated from a law school that doesn't even exist anymore, the Transylvania University Law School. So here he was with the great giant intellectuals of his day with a relatively modest background. But it was Justice Harlan who had the moral vision to see the evil underlying the separate but equal ruling. I'm sure that those other Supreme Court judges, since they're on the Supreme Court, had the highest grades in law schools, the equivalent of law review to the extent they were doing law reviews then. But the guy from the modest background was the one who saw the inherent injustice in the separate but equal ruling. Now, I love it when students do well on law school exams. There's nothing I love reading more than a law school exam, but all that is the sign that you think like me. And for the people graduating with all these high grades today from the Harvard and Columbias and Stanfords and so forth, it's a sign they're thinking like they're law professors. But you know what? The law only evolves, the law only changes when you get people in positions of importance who don't think like their professors. So I want all of you to keep that in mind. Some of you are doing great in law school. Fine. They'll open up doors and opportunities. But even if your GPA isn't what you'd like it to be, that's just a sign you aren't thinking like me. Go out there and change the world.
Last year, this sort of series of podcasts focused somewhat more about what it would be like inside the professor's actual classroom. So getting to have this discussion was good. And speaking about experiences in the classroom, I'm curious on what your experiences as a professor, that what have you noticed has sort of either stayed the same or been different inside of the classroom with all the students you've seen come in, as we've sort of already contextualized the societal and cultural shifts, but not really into the classroom. I know one of the examples that you used to tell us last year was that there was no curve at Loyola until the students actually demanded one.
That's right. Loyola was the last law school to adopt a curve, and it's actually the students. It was in the mid-1990s. The students passed along a petition demanding a curve. So actually, the curve was initiated by students. Well, when I first started teaching, we certainly didn't have the technology that we do now. And I'll say that the classroom wasn't as much, well, we certainly had fun, but students present themselves to me as being more serious. But then that's probably because I was more serious. Didn't have social media. I will say that it might well be that students had no option but to listen to what I'm saying. But I'm always assuming that when I see students clanking on their laptops, they're putting down what I'm saying. But then I go to law professor conferences and they tell me, "I know you love your students, Neil, but trust me, they aren't all writing down what you're saying. They're shopping online and other things. I know."
And on that, it's really easy to get involved in law school. There's so many organizations. We've talked about BALSA and APALSA, for example. There's so many different opportunities and events. But when you become a lawyer, sometimes it seems like the priorities tend to shift away from being involved in your immediate legal community. And as we've discussed today, getting involved and building community has been important to you. So how would you say that you have stayed involved and managed to stay connected to community after finishing law school, as many lawyers haven't been able to, unfortunately.
Yes, well, one thing about being embedded in law school, that makes it a lot. I have many more possibilities. I'm always being contacted by former students, and we go out, have lunches, spend some time with each other. I'm always delighted to hear about students and how they're getting along. It's given me the opportunity to do things like work with the Cook County Bar Association Foundation. Of all things, and I know exactly what you're talking about. When you are in practice, particularly when you're an associate, there's so much work to do all the time. I found myself being isolated to just working with people in the corporate and securities group and not having enough other things going on in my life. That's one of the reasons why, when I had the opportunity to come to Loyola, that I left Sidley and Austin for Loyola, because it's given me ways, a number of ways, to stay in the community. But again, the value of networking, mutual support, that's valuable to your lives in so many ways, and it will help give value to your lives. And I'm hoping some of you will aspire to become law professors. I want to encourage people, to the extent you can, to get clerkships, state and federal level. Again, tremendous networking opportunity, valuable experience. And there are programs in place at a number of law schools now that are geared at preparing graduates for the legal teaching market. We do have graduates of Loyola on several law faculties. I'd like to see more. So I would also like to encourage you all to enter the teaching profession as well.
I'm definitely happy to hear you sort of talk about. I know you started off with a clerkship and then you pivoted to Sidley and made your way to law teaching. And I think it can be really overwhelming to think about, graduation and think about, the first job. But I think it's also important to keep in mind, like you've shared so beautifully with us this evening, it's just one step and, post law school can really lead people to a myriad of different, pathways. And so I'd love for you to share, is there, a lesson or some valuable skills that you gained from clerking and the big law experience that you think have been really pivotal for you as a law professor now?
Yes. It's in the clerking experience, it's nothing like having to deal directly with real world legal issues and having the ability to sit down with Judge Layton. We would always write drafts of responses to motions, including memorandums, and getting his perspective on where a particular case is headed and how a particular motion should be decided. That one-on-one mentoring was absolutely irreplaceable. And as a law professor, it also gives me perspective I can bring into the classroom on ways to bring the cases to life. Sometimes you read a case, it doesn't seem all that exciting, but if you can sort of say, explain the real world situations in which the parties found themselves and distill the issue that's at the core of a case and how you would go about possibly deciding the case, and pointing out also that many cases, there's strong arguments for and against a particular result. My time in clerking certainly helped me to develop this skill. At Sidley in Austin, I was doing transactional work, and I worked with some mentors who were real sticklers for paying attention to every word in every document. And if you put something into a document without thinking about it, if you miss something, because you're usually starting with a document that was used in another transaction, so you have to think about the ways in which this transaction is similar or the same to the other transaction, but also ways in which it's different from the other transaction. How you listen carefully to what it is your client wants to accomplish. And on top of everything else, I mean reading carefully, reading every line, reading every definition. A well-drafted transactional document will have a section there at the beginning with definitions. You have to keep that in mind and how you bring all of that together. That attention to detail and to the craft of good lawyering, I certainly picked up at Sidley, and also adds to what I'm able to bring to the classroom. Without the clerkship experience and without that 5 years real world legal experience at Sidley in Austin, I don't think I'd be nearly as effective a teacher as I am. I remember when I was at Sidley, the group that was responsible at the time, the commercial law group, I believe they renamed it into a transactional arm and litigation arm since. The transactional group was, that commercial law group was aimed in large part on secured transactions work. And I remember overhearing a partner once say to an associate, been there a couple of years, but you I don't know what it is, you just don't understand secured transactions. So my goal is to make sure when my students step into that situation, they know the basics of secured transactions. Of course, when you're doing things on a day-to-day basis, you have to have deeper knowledge. But if you don't understand the framework going in, you're going to be lost. And that's such a potentially remunerative area of practice. And again, every organization, so this, my goal is to provide valuable learning to students which they can actually use out in practice. And I run into students from time to time who say they still have their commercial codes on the bookshelves in their offices, and will consult their commercial codes from time to time.
That's really great. And I know this is definitely a full circle moment coming back to text. You know, in some ways, I like to say that storytelling and my love of literature was my first love, and then teaching was my second. But I think studying law and getting to be around lawyers is definitely making its way on the list. I've really enjoyed my time at Loyola. But I did, you know, I wanted to end off with a fun fact for our Podvocate listeners. And rumor has it, Professor Williams, you might have been responsible for setting up two young Chicago lawyers. Is that correct?
Yes, it is correct. I was at Sidley in Austin in the summer of 1989, right before I started teaching in the fall of 1989. And there was a certain summer associate named Barack Obama. I'd never seen anything like Barack Obama's coming to Sidley for a summer clerkship. There were partners who were just besides themselves about how wonderful he was. Of course, he was the first Black president at Harvard Law Review, but he just had a way. People were gushing all over about him in a way you knew he was someone very special. So I had the opportunity to get to know him early on. I was present, as he put it. And we have the video from his King Day speech in January of 1999. But as he put it, I was present when he met Michelle. They already talked together on the phone, and the Sidley and Austin partner who was in charge of the mentorship program and assigned Michelle to be Barack's mentor loves to take credit for their meeting, and that's fine. But I happened to be there when Barack came into the room for his first mentorship meeting with Michelle. And I saw Barack's face when he laid eyes on her in person for the very first time. His eyes lit up like stars. It was obvious from the very beginning that he was smitten by Michelle. And I am the one who got to say, "Michelle Robinson, this is Barack Obama," and see that big, broad smile across his face. Now, Michelle wanted to keep it professional. After all, she was his mentor in a work environment. So she tried to keep it professional, but it didn't take him very long to break down that shell. And of course, they began dating. But I am the one who got to say, "Michelle Robinson, this is Barack Obama," and see his eyes as he looked at her for the very first time. I always like to say that my contribution to history in this regard is that I sent out a burst of positive energy, unspoken, but to the effect, "Michelle, give Barack a chance. Michelle, give Barack a chance." I'm the one who sent out that subliminal message. So that is my contribution to history.
Thank you for sharing the story, Professor.
Oh, you're so welcome. And as I told you, Barack did give his King Day speech here at the law school 10 years to the day from when he was inaugurated as president. He started his 10-year journey at the law school. Oh, and in the walls of the law school, because Barack actually visited the law school on several other occasions. You'll see pictures on the walls of the law school at various places of Barack interacting with Loyolans.
Thank you, Professor Williams, for coming on the Podvocate. We really appreciate your time. Do you have any final words of wisdom before we sign off the air?
Just a distillation of what I've been saying so far. Network, get to know one another, show love and support for one another, work hard to make the world a better place. And you can do it. You will do it. And please take advantage of the resources available at the law school to help you along this journey. We are all on the faculty and in the administration so grateful because students don't have to come to Loyola. But for those students who do come and who are really respectful of our anti-racist and anti-oppression mission, we truly treasure everyone who comes. And thank you. It's been a real treasure to have this opportunity to share insights about the law school and its rich history.
Thank you so much for joining us, Professor.
Thank you, Professor.
That's all from us here at The Podvocate. Thank you again for joining us today. Our team wants to hear from you, so if there's a topic you want the show to cover, please email us at thepodvocate@gmail.com. Also, visit our website at thepodvocate.com for more information on this episode and our guests. The Podvocate is produced by WLUW, the student-run independent radio station broadcasting from the School of Communications at Loyola Chicago. Our editors-in-chief are Neka Ugu and Andy Vandenbush. Our senior editors are Casey Callahan and Marcus McNeil. Our associate editors are Johannes Alvarez-Rivero, Karan Kaushal, Maris Medina, and Ben Recht. Special thanks to the Associate Director of Student Affairs, Professor Radhika Sutherland, and Dean Stephen Rushen for providing the resources and support to make this show possible. From Loyola University Chicago School of Law, this has been The Podvocate.